You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. This is Gudar Zaktudari, your host for the Voices of the Middle East. This is Thursday, November 10th, and it's another installment of Voices of the Middle East. There are quite a few things happening in the past few weeks in the Middle East that really worth mentioning. But I would really start with maybe dedicating this show to a act of compassion by a Palestinian father, his name is Ismail Khatib, who decided to donate the body parts of his 12-year-old son, Ahmed, who was killed by an Israeli operation in Jenin. And he donated parts of the dead body to, six Israelis from 7 months old to 58 years old, and the kidney, the heart, and many other parts were donated. And when he was asked why he's doing it, he mentioned that he thinks what Middle East needs is compassion and peace. And I wholeheartedly agree with him, and I wish the little Ahmad was also alive to see the resurrection of his soul and his father's dedication to peace in the Middle East in other people's bodies. This was received with lots of interest, both in Israeli population and also Palestinians, and a deputy minister kind of visited Mr. Khatib, I think it's Mr. Olmert, who deputy minister, contacted Mr. Khatib and invited him to go to Jerusalem. But it's not known whether this is going to happen. And Isaac Frankenthal, who is an Israeli father of a 19-year-old son who was killed 11 years ago, he welcomed the olive branch from Ismail Khatib, and also he gave him a call and told him that we need more of these actions in the Middle East. So that's for the beginning of the show, but at the same time we know that peace is nowhere to be found in the Middle East. Yesterday there was three acts of terrorism in Amman, Jordan, with more than 60 casualties. In Iraq, every day is the same day, 30, 40 people. Yesterday, 30 people were killed in a restaurant. And all the operations that are going on all over the world still calls for an action, an international action, to stop the violence, both on the side of occupation and the so-called resistance in the Middle East, whether it's going to be in the Israel and Palestine or in Iraq or in Afghanistan. The cycle of violence had to stop. For tonight's show, I have a couple of guests lined up, and I would invite you to listen to another piece of music, and then we will be back. I need to make phone calls to these two guests, who are all, both of them are from East Coast, from New Jersey, and we'll call in a moment. apologize for this long pause. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to get Dr. Amir Ahmadi online, but I am having Dr. Beeman. Welcome to the show, Dr. Beeman.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate it, you waiting so long.
No problem.
Yeah, it's very difficult to find Hushang. I called the number he left me, but I couldn't contact, so I'm waiting for him to call back again. The reason that we are kind of interested to, to welcome you back in my show is that you recently published a book about really the Iran and U.S. relation, and it's titled for audience if they want to make sure and search for purchasing it. It's called The Great Satan versus the Mad Mullahs, How the United States and Iran Demonize Each Other. And it's actually the story of the day. Could you give us a little introduction on what's going on these days, and especially on after the recent comments by President Ahmadinejad regarding the wiping out of Israel or wiping out of Zionism? And what is your take on the whole situation there?
Well, certainly. First of all, with regard to the book, it's important, I think, that everybody sit back and realize that the United States and Iran have been at odds with each other for nearly 30 years. There's almost no pair of nations that's been so completely out of contact in a formal sense with each other for such a very long time. For the United States, the only other nation that we have not had diplomatic relations with for such a long time as Cuba. And the United States and Iran don't really hold any intrinsic danger for each other. The only danger that they really have for each other is the danger that they've created for each other by threatening both each other and also their allies. So it is a very curious state of affairs that the two nations communicate almost exclusively through the media, and they continue to demonize each other and insult each other without any clear idea about why, because the United States has no, doesn't seem to have any prescription for having Iran, for stopping the kinds of behavior that they're displaying toward Iran. And Iran has no real prescription for stopping the kinds of behavior that they're exhibiting toward the United States. So this seems to be continuing indefinitely. In the book, I point out that for an Iranian audience, they may understand this very well because the United States and Iran are in a state of qahr with each other. For those who don't understand Persian, this means a state of non-communication, where the two parties are still involved in a relationship, but they nevertheless continue to bother each other and to remind each other that they are still they still exist and that they still are involved in some kind of a relationship. So it's a very painful and difficult situation. The United States continues to insult Iran by using some version of the insult, the Mad Mullah, and Iran continues to insult the United States by invoking the image of the great Satan, and this continues to go on. In the Iranian discourse, Iran knows that by making disparaging remarks about the government of Israel, they also are indirectly attacking the United States. And so the remarks that were leveled against Israel were directed as much toward the United States as they were toward Israel. And the United States, of course, continues to come right back with claims about irrational behavior and outlaw indecent behavior on the part of the Iranian government, and so the argument continues.
In some of your writing, I have noted that you find some similarities between two presidents as far as how they approach and how they deal with each other, and the use of, for example, evil terms for the other. And it's very similar when Ahmadinejad is talking the same as President Bush is talking about Iran and the devil doers. How did you come up with this kind of similar aspect of these two guys in power?
Well, first of all, I'm an anthropologist, and anthropologists are very attuned to the use of symbolic discourse. We know that that people tend to look at the world from their own perspective, or from the perspective of their own culture. And Iran has a vision of evil that has been promulgated. It's not just since the revolution, but actually the image of evil has been pretty consistent for some centuries. The idea of the shaitan, or the Satan, as an outside force that is corrupting of the inner purity of a person or a group or a nation is very old. And in fact, the images that were used in the revolution of Imam Hussein being martyred by corrupt outside forces were used very extensively during the revolution. In fact, those of your listeners who may have been in Iran and remember this, remember that there were street chants that said, literally, Iran has become Karbala, and the United States was, the Shah was compared to Yazid, the general that cut off the head of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. So the image of the United States as an external outside corruptor who was supporting an evildoer, namely from the standpoint of the revolution, the Shah, of course, was a very old image, but it was used very effectively during the revolution. And for the United States, the revolution and the revolutionary figures really threatened the world order, and primarily through the hostage crisis, the 444-day detention of American officials in the Iranian embassy. And the Iran was said by the United States to not be playing by the rules, and so therefore they were outlaws, they were crazy, they were disruptive of world order. And this, for the United States, was also an image of evil.
Now back to the discussion of the day after the comments about Zionism. You noted in one writing that Mr. Ahmadinejad was talking about Zionism and not Israel. Is there any distinction between these two terms in Iranian political vocabulary?
Absolutely. And this is something that the United States and Israel, in fact, fail to recognize. The distinction may be too subtle for many listeners, but the Iranian regime, since the time of the revolution, has always been careful to make a distinction between Zionism as a political movement and the state of Israel and Judaism. In fact, in Islam, I think, as most of your listeners will understand and know, that in Islam, the Jews are part of the protected people, the people of the book. And there are more than 100,000 Iranian Jews still in Iran, and many people of Jewish heritage that have left Iran but still consider themselves Iranian. So the insult was not meant to be directed toward Jews, but rather toward Zionism, which is considered to be an illegitimate political movement from the standpoint of Iranian political discourse. So the words that Mr. Ahmadinejad used, first of all, they were not his words. They were the words of the Ayatollah Khomeini, and it was the Zionist regime. The idea would be, what they were calling for was for the removal of the Zionist regime from Israel. And later, the Iranian foreign ministry, noting the world reaction, actually came back and really backpedaled on his remarks, saying that Iran had no intention of attacking anybody and that Iran's policy was to try to foster a peaceful solution of the Palestinian question. So there was some disparity between the words that Mr. Ahmadinejad used and the words of the rest of the Iranian government or the Iranian establishment. And I think that was not an accident. We have a we have a real growing difference between Mr. Ahmadinejad and his supporters and the establishment in the government in Iran, that is primarily those people who support and have supported Ayatollah Khamenei.
I want to kind of follow up on the same problem and how it's being perceived by the Western media and Western countries, these remarks. Do you see any relation with creating a pretext for a sort of preemption action against Iran, especially looking at the nuclear activities that are going on in that country?
The neoconservatives in the United States have been lobbying for some time for the United States to carry out the next part of the agenda that they have had on their books since 1992, and that is for a complete overhaul of the political regimes in the Middle East. The first stage of their agenda was the destruction of Saddam Hussein in Iraq. The next was an attack on Syria, finally an attack on Iran. Their agenda was, in fact, to change the governments in this region in order eventually to create a situation of safety for the current government of Israel, which they felt was under attack and under siege. They felt by removing the governments in these countries, then that would undercut support for all of the violent groups that were attacking Israel, and that would bring peace to the Israeli-Palestinian problem. So the neoconservatives have had their sights out for changing the regime in Iran for some time, but they have to find a justification that the American public would support. And of all of the reasons why the United States would be justified in the eyes of Americans for attacking a sovereign nation, the one that seems to play the best with the American public is the question of a nuclear threat. And you can see exactly how the Bush regime used the idea of a nuclear threat in order to convince the American public to go along with the invasion of Iraq. So the nuclear threat is again being used as a pretext on the part of the neoconservatives to try to convince the government and the American people that it would be reasonable for there to be an attack against Iran. And when Mr. Ahmadinejad makes threatening remarks or seemingly threatening remarks against Israel, this only strengthens the rhetoric in Washington on the part of neoconservatives to indicate that Iran is a military threat to the region. Never mind that Iran has never been found by any inspection agency or any international atomic energy group to have had a nuclear weapons program. There is no evidence of one, and the Iranians themselves have completely have not only denied that they have a nuclear weapons program, but that they would ever have a nuclear weapons program. So we have no evidence at all that there is such a thing, nevertheless, it's being used as a pretext for some kind of violent action against Iran.
But regardless of whether there is a program at the moment, how feasible it is for Iranian government, even with one or two nuclear warheads, to be really considered a threat when the Pakistan and India in one hand and Israel have numerous, I guess, warheads and a whole stockpiles of nuclear weapons in their hand. So,
well, your point is very well taken, and this is what Iranians say too. They say that here's Pakistan with actually identifiable nuclear weapons, India with identifiable nuclear weapons, and Israel with identifiable nuclear weapons, and the United States seems to be quite comfortable with letting Pakistan or India or Israel, in fact, have a full nuclear arsenal, and yet they're they're really excited and very upset, seemingly anyway, in their political rhetoric, about the possibility that Iran might have a nuclear weapons program. Even the CIA says that if Iran were to start a nuclear weapons program somehow with what they have today, it would still be 5 to 10 years before they would even be able to develop their first nuclear warhead. And as I say, there is no evidence that there is even a nuclear program at all anyway. But the Iran also knows that if they were to use any kind of nuclear weapon, or in fact any weapon, offensively against any of their neighbors, much less Israel, that the retaliation would be very swift and would be disastrous for Iran. So I am convinced that that Iranians are, in fact, not crazy, and that if they were to use any weapons at all, they would be in a defensive posture rather than offensive posture. And history bears us out. Iran has not attacked any nation at all for more than two centuries. So that the historical record really shows a lack of a disposition on the part of Iran to be aggressive against its neighbors.
Do you see any danger or any situation, especially with coming to power of Mr. Ahmadinejad, who somehow represents the intelligence and military factions of the Iranian Revolution, and the positions that mostly is given to people from the Revolutionary Guard and intelligence ministry in different capacity of the government. Do you see any change? I mean, I know you were in Iran during the election. What is your take on the shift in the government and power in the country?
Well, Mr. Ahmadinejad was indeed supported by people who participated in the original revolution, but more importantly, people who were veterans of the Iran-Iraq War. There are two groups that have been identified as principal supporters. One that, you know, where he was the founder. This is the so-called Isar Yaran, and the second, the Abad Yaran. These two groups seem to be closely related. As we know, political groups in Iran are very flexible, and they seem to come and go with regularity. But these two groups have a very strong ideology that is trying to take Iran back to the original ideals of the original revolution. And they're military in the sense that they're composed a great deal of veterans and some people who are in fact involved with the Pasdaran. What has come to the fore is very interesting. Mr. Ahmadinejad campaigned on the idea of the original revolutionary idea that there would be equality of economic opportunity for Iranians. And he notes in a rather subtle way, but nevertheless notes that the establishment, the conservative religious establishment, has in fact become corrupt and has become very wealthy, and that the wealth situation for the poorer classes in Iran and workers has not improved in proportion to the overall improvement of the economy. And so one of the things that he proposed, for instance, was that the government have a subsidized program that would allow people from the lower economic groups to be able to purchase shares in state industry, for instance. And I think that a lot of factory owners and essentially capitalists in Iran became very nervous because they thought that that the next step would be to privatize to governmentalize
or to seize
private industry or to force private industry to sell shares to the general population. And so there's been quite a lot of capital flight from Iran as a result. And these rather harsh rhetorical moves with regard to the West and with regard to Europe have been considered by the establishment to be rather ill-conceived and rather clumsily carried out, but nevertheless, it's very popular with a certain class of the population who wants to see Iran take a strong position vis-a-vis the West, that's where they feel that they've been persecuted and insulted. So it's partly rhetorical, of course, and I don't see Iran taking actually any military action in the region as an offensive measure, but increasing at least the rhetoric with regard to their defensive posture. So it's been thus far primarily these economic issues that have been the real actions that have been taken by the government. What also is interesting, though, for me, is that people expected Mr. Ahmadinejad, if he came into power, to be conservative in all sorts of ways, and that included curtailing the relatively looser freedoms that people had gained with regard to public behavior and personal behavior in the Islamic Republic. And thus far, the new government has really done nothing to try to clamp down on the more liberal behavior that we've seen in the streets.
Well, thank you, Dr. Bimelnar. Let's take a short music break, and I would like to invite listeners to call in after the music break. The phone number here is 503-231-8187. Again, 503-231-8187 if you have any question for Professor Beeman. Thank you.
تصور کن اگه حتی تصور کردنش سخته، جهانی که هر انسانی تو اون خوشبخته، جهانی که تو اون پول و نژاد و قدرت ارزش نیست، جواب هم صدایی ها پلیس ضد شورش نیست، نه بمب هسته ای داره، نه بمب افکن، نه خمپاره، دیگه هیچ بچه ای پاشو روی مین جا نمیذاره، همه آزاد آزادن، همه بی درد بی دردن، تو روزنامه نمیخونی نهنگا خودکشی کردن. جهانی رو تصور کن بدون نفرت و بارود، بدون ظلم خود کامه، بدون وحشت و تابوت، جهانی رو تصور کن پر از لبخند و آزادی، لبا لب از گل و بوسه، پر از تکرار آبادی. تصور کن اگه حتی تصور کردنش جرمه، اگه با بردن اسمش گلو پر میشه از سرمه، تصور کن جهانی رو که توش زندانی افسانه است، تمام جنگای دنیا شدن مشمول آتش بس، کسی آقای عالم نیست، برابر با همان مردم، دیگه سهم هر انسانه تن هر دونه گندم، بدون مرز و محدوده وطن یعنی همه دنیا، تصور کن تو میتونی بشی تعبیر این رویا.
Well, you were listening to a Persian version of Imagine, and it was translated by Siavash Qumeshi. It was called Tasavvur Kon. Dr. Bima, welcome back again.
Thank you.
Let me ask you a question. I mean, the reason I invited Dr. Amir Ahmadi to talk was that he wrote an article, an opinion ad, regarding the really a threat of a preemptive action against Iran and the way neocons are trying to kind of move the country toward a situation prior to Iraq war, but this time against Iran. And we know that there are several fronts that U.S. foreign policy is now taking us. One is against Syria, and then the other one is against Iran. Dr. Ahmadi mentioned that we are complacent in this situation if we don't do much to stop it. I would like to see what is your opinion of what general public can do to put a stop in this kind of movement and actions.
Certainly, there are several things. I'm very sorry that I did not read Dr. Amir Ahmadi's article, but I certainly agree with the sentiments that you've presented, and I also know him to be a very sober and very fine analyst. So I'm certain that it was an excellent article. I'm very worried myself for a number of reasons. First of all, I think that the United States believes or knows, or the people in the military know, that the United States right now would really be incapable by itself of launching any kind of a military attack against Iran. We have our military forces are terribly stretched out. With the it would be political suicide for the Bush administration to reintroduce the draft in the United States, and the forces, the voluntary forces that we have, are in the field for much, much longer than they were in any other conflict in the history of the United States. They're running 1 and 2 year tours of duty, and they're exhausted. And many of them are older, and they're not really trained for this kind of combat. So our situation in Iraq has really made it very improbable that the U.S. could do this alone. What the United States has been trying to do instead is to try to stir up other groups that might have problems with the Iranian government, and to try to use surrogates to attack the Iranian government. The first group of surrogates is the Mujahideen Khalq, or the so-called MEK or MKO, as they're talked about in American parlance. And I think that many of your listeners will know who these people are. They were part of the original revolution. They were before the revolution in 1978-79. They actually were responsible for killing some American officials. And they're on the official American terrorist list. They fled to Iraq after they were purged 6 months after the revolution. They were protected by Saddam Hussein. They remained in Iraq during the Iran-Iraq War, and many people inside Iran considered them to be traitors. However, they are they're really desperate to try to eradicate the current government in Iran, and I believe that they have created a shadow government of their own and would like to take over. The problem for the United States is that, unfortunately, many neoconservatives, I'll mention names here, Daniel Pipes, Patrick Claussen, are two of them, who have advocated that the United States use the Mujahideen Khalq as a kind of a strike force against the government of Iran. The United States purposely kept the borders of Kurdistan with Iraq open as a way of allowing the Mujahideen Khalq to infiltrate Iran from Iraq, where they were stationed. And we have American legislators who have actually supported them and have provided American taxpayer money for their support. These are Sam Brownback of Kansas, Rick Santorum of Pennsylvania, and Representative Ileana Ross-Lehtinen of Florida. These are three of the principal supporters of this of this group here in the United States. Additionally, we have groups that are trying to start a liberation movement from Azerbaijan. Ahmed Cheragani is one of them, and they've been talking regularly to the U.S. Department of Defense to try to figure out a way for some of these movements to actually take over the government. The American Enterprise Institute in Washington is one of the hotbeds of this kind of activity. One of the principal cheerleaders for this kind of work is Michael Ledeen, who has appeared many times in California before Iranian immigrant groups and has made all kinds of promises. For instance, saying that if the Iranians in California would put up $500,000, then he would know where to spend that money, and that that they could get rid of the government in Tehran. All of these schemes are crazy. The Iranian people, in my opinion, would never allow the Mujahideen Khalq to come in and take over their government. The idea of a revolt from Azerbaijan makes no sense to me. Most Azerbaijanis are certainly proud of their language, Azeri, and they're proud of their heritage, but they also consider themselves culturally to be Iranians. And there are so many prominent and important Azerbaijani people of Azerbaijani heritage in Iran that I find that an almost impossible situation. And attempts to stir up the Kurdish population have also not been successful. So these schemes are really quite mad, and I think that Iran is not in any imminent danger from any of these, but I do believe that they are, they're certainly not, they don't bode well for a positive relationship between the United States and Iran in the immediate future.
I'm talking to Professor William Beeman, who is a professor of anthropology and director of Middle East Studies at Brown University, and we have a caller online. Caller, you're on the air.
Thank you. Very much enjoying the program, and thank you, Professor. I wondered, I read a great book last year called The Lost Science of Money by Stephen Zarlenga, and he talks in that book about how the government, whether by intent or secondarily, takes the credit of banks to create the huge funds which are then used to prosecute these wars. Could you talk a little bit about that in relation to the tension between Iran and the West at this time?
You know, you really have me at a disadvantage. I have not read the book, and I'm not familiar with that argument, but it really intrigues me. Could you explain it a little more?
Well, yeah. This guy, Stephen Zarlenga, worked on Wall Street for a long time. He's got a degree from the University of Chicago, and he's affiliated with the American Monetary Institute now. And in the book, essentially, it's a history of capital, money itself, and the way it's been used throughout history from, you know, pre-Roman times up to the present. And essentially, the argument he makes is that banks are very much responsible for these wars because they're issuing the credit upon which the wars are fought. And, whether by collusion with government officials or people in the arms industry, he makes the case in the book that we've had this pattern for 2,000 years because we've had so much capital amassed since the Roman imperial days by certain groups of people that they can literally afford to manipulate history to their own advantage.
Well, it's a really intriguing thought, and there's no question that in the Middle East, and in particular with regard to Iran, the question of capital is very important. And one thing that I could point out to you, a series of recent articles actually have talked about the fact that Iran is threatening to denominate oil sales in euros rather than in dollars.
Interesting.
And this creates a great danger for the United States.
Yeah,
because if Iran decides to denominate oil sales in euros, then their great customers, China in particular and Japan, would find it much less reasonable for to hold dollars. Since the United States is a tremendous debtor nation to both China and Japan, where really they're really propping up our currency. That is a great threat to the United States. And the theories that put forward that Iran's government must go, not because it's supporting terrorism. There's very little actually evidence of that, or because of the nuclear threat, which is a sham. But really, because of this threat, the capital threat.
Well, that is brilliant, and I didn't know that, and it ties in exactly with the points he makes in the book. Zarlinga argues that Rome's major wars were all fought because of monetary reasons, because of other countries trying to corner the markets on silver or, you know, various other machinations.
Well, there is no question that the United States is in the capital in the United States is in real danger because of our horrendous balance of trade deficit, and also because of the enormous amounts of U.S. dollars that are being held by China and Japan.
Uh-huh.
It's also very interesting, I think, to note that that Iran has a positive balance of trade with China and with Japan.
Interesting.
As a matter of fact, India has a positive balance of trade with China and with Japan. So in some sense, we are indirectly subsidizing Iran and India through our deficit with those two countries.
I'd like to follow up on that question of what may cause all these challenges that we are facing. And that's if we really are going to have a shortage of fossil fuel and oil. The fact that Iran owns resources of uranium and prohibiting this country from being able to enrich and actually sell as a nuclear fuel, that may be also another reason for all these fuss and kind of denying the right to this country for their future replacement for the fossil fuel.
Yeah, I mean, Iran does have uranium reserves. They don't quite have the refining capacity for the uranium to be able to produce it in large enough quantities, but it could certainly be developed. I find it really problematic for the United States indirectly, because we don't have any relations with Iran, but indirectly to try to restrict Iran's ability to actually develop these facilities. And what people seem to forget is that it was the United States originally that instigated the nuclear energy development in Iran. It was at the United States' suggestion that Iran even started it. The United States gave Iran the first model nuclear reactor. President Gerald Ford offered Iran a full nuclear cycle in 1976, and the present nuclear energy plant in Bushehr was actually started at United States' suggestion before the revolution. The United States has for years supported nuclear energy development in Iran, and why? Because they were suggesting that Iran save its petroleum resources for other purposes, and that in fact is what Iran has done. They've found that that natural gas, which is being used to generate electricity, is much more profitably sold to other nations in the form of liquid natural gas.
Well, Professor Beeman, I appreciate you giving us this time. Unfortunately, we're getting close to the end of the hour. And one more time, I'd like to emphasize that Professor Beeman has just published a book. It's called The Great Satan Versus the Mad Mullahs, How the United States and Iran Demonize Each Other.
Right.
Could you give some information about where this book can be purchased?
Online at Amazon.com or at BarnesandNoble.com, or directly from the publisher, which is Prager, which is an imprint of Greenwood Press. And that's www.greenwood.com, or at Amazon or Barnes & Noble. And you can also ask your local bookstore to order it for you if they don't have it in stock.
Sure. Thank you very much. And again, appreciate it. Hopefully we can have you again on the show.
I hope so, too. And I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Complete the show tonight with a little piece that came out on Tom Paine and Common Sense website. It's written by Rami Khoury, who is the editor-at-large of Beirut-based Daily Star. And it's about the whole riots in France and kind of talks about why the North African and Middle Eastern youth who are migrating to Europe end up in these situations of violence and really what causes all these. He writes, the pattern of young people from the Middle East and North Africa getting into trouble, as we used to say in the 60s, has evolved in recent decades from isolated and episodic incidents into a veritable global phenomenon. The trouble these days, however, is not local gangsterism or self-inflicted problems with drugs or crime. The structural problems of young Arabs, North Africans and Asians, economic, social and political, have emigrated with them to other parts of the world. Many in our region and abroad have warned for three decades now of the dangers of ignoring the obvious stresses and disequilibria that plague so many young people in the Arab-Asian region. The cost of continued inaction and irresponsibility is not only higher now, it is also spreading around the world. The news Tuesday was typical. Young men of North African origin burned cars and clashed with police throughout France for nearly 2 weeks straight. A smaller incidence of random violence in German cities. Young Middle Eastern immigrants are arrested in Australia before setting off a potentially catastrophic series of terror bombings. Throughout the Middle East and North Africa, young men continue to feed the recruiting lines of suicide bombers, resistance fighters, social, economic, and political militants, freelance terrorists, and legitimate peaceful Islamic activists, all sharing a common attribute across the continent. They are dissatisfied with their current status and prospect in society, and they will no longer stew in silence. They have moved beyond passive acceptance of their fate to the point of engaging in dynamic, violent actions that they see as assertive, redemptive, or simply an appropriate expression of their anger, humiliation, marginalization, and above all, fear. The causes of the violent, often nihilistic, acts of young Middle Eastern men around the world are neither unknown nor beyond the realm of corrective policies. There are no puzzles here. The core problem is mass degradation and alienation that manifest themselves in two milieus simultaneously in urban belts of educated, usually unemployed young men throughout Arab Asian towns and cities, and in the parallel urban zones of mass disenfranchisement and marginalization that have become more common and visible in Western Europe, North America, and Australia. This is a cruelly recurring problem of inadequate integration and citizenship rights that plagues a young man in his own country and again when he and his family emigrate to Western lands. Arab experts and colleagues abroad have repeatedly documented the multifaceted malaise of Arab youth, poor education, abuse of power, limited and unequal economic opportunities, lack of personal freedoms, cultural alienation, substandard housing, poverty, quality of life disparities, hyper-urbanization, the stresses of internal or international migration, low global competitiveness, weakening family and community networks, changing gender roles, the impact of global media and increasing environmental pressures, to mention only the most obvious. He goes on and says, one reason for this is International Labor Organization, ILO, data shows that high population growth rates in the past decades have been coupled with a high labor force growth rate of 3.3% a year. Labor markets have done a poor job in trying to absorb the 3.6 million people every year who enter the job market. They will do not better from now until 2015, during which the labor force is expected to grow by 2.6% annually, meaning that some 4 million new workers will seek jobs every year. Only one in every third young person is working. In a region that suffers the highest youth unemployment rates in the world, around 30%. With that, I would end the show, and thank you very much for listening. This was Voices of the Middle East, and Gud Isaac is our host.